From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 569, Managing Customizations in SharePoint Online, with guest Andrew Connell. Recorded Tuesday, December 19th, 2017. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Got a brand new guest for you today. This is Andrew Connell, who's a full-stack web developer with a focus on Microsoft Azure and Office 365, specifically the Office 365 APIs, SharePoint, Microsoft's .NET Framework and .NET Core, Angular, Node.js, and Docker. He enjoys development, writing, and teaching. If it's in the cutting edge of web, you'll find Andrew there. He's received Microsoft's MVP award every year since 2005 and has helped thousands of developers through the various courses he's authored and taught both in person and online. Recently, he launched his own on-demand video platform called Voitanos at voitanos.io to deliver his own on-demand video training. Welcome, sir.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
Great to have you on board. It's kind of embarrassing to make 560 of these things and never have you on, because you've been in the SharePoint space since there was SharePoint, pretty much.
I've got the gray hair to prove it as well. Yeah, it is. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller for your show, so it's I don't feel new. How's that?
Well, and we see each other at conferences and things on a regular basis. So it's like, yeah, we've always kind of known each other. I think we've been MVPs equally as long. So interesting to see what's happened in the SharePoint space. Just this, the move to the cloud and the Office 365 APIs. I just don't think that the average IT guy is even aware of the programmability available into the Azure product.
I don't think so either. You know, one of the things that I see that's been really interesting, and I guess the last two build conferences that Microsoft has done have really exposed this, is that, you know, I think, you know, my bio says the Office 365 APIs. And as you read that, even though I've been using that bio for a couple months, I realized that I probably should change that to the Microsoft Graph, because most developers I find are still surprised or not aware of what the Microsoft Graph is and how you can get to anything in Office 365 and stuff inside Azure. And when you see how much it's actually mentioned at during build keynotes and stuff, I mean, it's just, it's amazing what they're doing with this API, that you can just touch so much stuff for your data.
And I got to think, from an IT perspective, when you look at this, it looks like just a big old security risk. Like, the graph to me immediately maps to user accounts, which means this is exposing privileges. This is exposing authentication authorization rights.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it does, in a sense that it still is very secure in the sense, because what you have is, it's backed by Azure AD for all authentication. And it really follows two different styles of authentication. One either as a delegated permission. So I can use the graph, or I can grant some other application to use the graph on my behalf, but I, as the individual, I, as Andrew, you, as Richard, have to explicitly grant that.
Right.
The other side is that, you know, allows a organization as a whole to say, we trust that application to do things on behalf of our users. We call those application permissions, but it is still something that either someone at your corporate IT is going to end up having to whitelist and bless, or the individual user is going to have to bless. And still, corporate IT can control what individual users can say that this third party app has the ability to touch their data. So it is still, I mean, they've done a really good job on the authentication piece. It's in a good way and a bad way, because it still gets really tough for developers to wrap their head around how the authentication flows work. But the nice thing is, they're not doing anything that's like a Microsoft-ism. I put that in air quotes.
Nice.
It's all just standard open schematics. We follow the same schema that the OData authentication and scheme really requires us to do. So they're not coming up with their own stuff. It's all very standards-based stuff.
Well, and I kind of like that, in the sense that, especially coming from a security guy perspective, that we are pushing the developer down the path of righteousness. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's hard, but if you make this work, it's actually secure.
It is. And, you know, it's funny. I remember I was at a conference just recently where a bunch of us were sitting around, you know, we're like, what you always do, what's the fun thing that conference speakers do? We all get together for dinner and talk about authentication. Woo! Thankfully, there were some really good chicken and sangria involved. But I guess we were all in violent agreement is the best way to say it, where we all agreed that authentication was easy, but it's also really hard.
Right.
And it's really hard to get. I think that, you know, everybody that explains OAuth and authentication to me, they make it so complicated. And once you can just get past that one little hurdle, once you get past that hurdle, then the developer is like going, oh, well, now it's a piece of cake. I just need a key. How do I get the key? Well, there's all these different ways. And whatever you're trying to do really self-selects you either into just one or maybe two different options that you can choose from and puts you in a much more kind of a Rails kind of experience. But still, it is tough. I mean, dealing with tokens or refresh tokens.
Are you making a Ruby on Rails reference there? Is that what that was?
A little bit.
Okay. That's really interesting. I mean, just this idea that those guys came before in the sense that they used standard security practices right off the bat so that IT has a conversation with development at the beginning of a project like this and set some basic security constraints in place and, you know, get that authentication working properly off the bat. And then it doesn't interfere with the developer after that. They've just already done it.
And that's the nice part about it. Once you get things set up and once they're clean and you're following standard protocols and standards, mm-hmm. then organizations are much more apt to trust those different applications or trust those systems. And corporate IT has a much better, I don't know what you say, warm fuzzy around it because they can trust that, oh, if your application relies on Azure AD for authentication, then we trust it. I had a conversation with an organization just recently and they were like, yeah, but we're not really sure if we trust Azure AD. I'm like, hold on one second. You know who Microsoft is, right? And they're like, yeah. But just because Microsoft says it's good, that doesn't mean that it's something we should trust. And I'm like, okay, well, don't just go based on what they say. Keep in mind two very important things. Everything in Azure and everything in Office 365 has one common thing and they all rely on Azure AD. And Microsoft IT no longer has their own data centers. I mean, they may have some still left that they're still migrating over, but
right.
all of their mail, all of their SharePoint, all of their data store and everything, all that stuff is in Azure that relies on Azure AD. So don't just do what they say, follow what they're doing. And they're betting the company on this thing.
Yeah. If this doesn't work, then Microsoft doesn't sell any of their stuff. Like it's broken across the board.
Exactly.
I like when we're in the same boat that their IT is in.
It's the best security conversation you can have with an organization where that,
sure.
you know, we think that we're more secure. Like, I don't mean to tell you that you're wrong, but my money's going to be on Microsoft or on Google or right. on Amazon or whatever on their IT groups because they've got a heck of a lot more writing on a compromise or a hack coming in than you do, even if you're like a Bank of America, a big company, right? They're hosting for everybody.
Sure. I remember seeing a sort of open Q&A with Scott Guthrie, who runs all of Azure. And somebody said, what keeps you up at night? And he says that we have a breach. Like that's his number one concern, that Azure ever gets breached. And they put a ton of energy, way more than I think any other organization could, into making sure that just simply never happens.
You know, I had an opportunity late in 2016 where there's an exception process. There's a service that Azure and Office 365 offer called ExpressRoute.
Yes.
And the 5-second version of it is that it allows you to not have to go through the internet to get to the Microsoft backbone. Instead, you can dedicate a circuit from your company to the Microsoft backbone for, of course, a nice price.
This is not free.
No. This is like $25,000 kind of a thing. One of the things I found was really cool is I went in for 2 days. I was teaching these two different organizations or these two different groups of ISPs in Asia what the exception process was like to be able to take advantage of for Office 365. But the cool part, the reason I'm telling you this is that the first day was done by the gentleman who owns all of the entire network for MSIT.
Wow.
And he went through and told probably 2 or 3 different anecdotal stories to the audience. And I'm not going to go into the details of what they are because, frankly, a lot of it gets over my head as a developer. But he was talking about a couple of the different really high profile hacks that had happened and how Microsoft was responding to them and how at the time they responded to compromises that were showing up, say, like in Hong Kong, and how their global operations detected it, how it responded to it, how they use AI to detect stuff. And I didn't grasp probably 75% of what he said, but my jaw was on the ground going, this is the kind of organization that I trust with my data.
That's actually fully on the leading edge. I've been asked recently about predictions. I said, you know, you wait and see how much Microsoft takes their new AI tech and applies it to their Azure products, not for us, but for themselves.
Yeah.
That I think that their ability to analyze attempts to attack, you know, those initial tests, those initial pokes that hackers make while they're trying to feel around for a weakness, they're going to get really good at identifying those early on.
One of the things he was talking about too is how they leverage those. This was just a few months removed from them announcing those FPGAs,
right?
The field programmable gate arrays.
Right.
And how they were taking advantage of this new hardware to go from a software-based networking to hardware-based networking, but at cloud scale, and use it as with a mix with the software networking. It was just when you start to see like, okay, here's a real-world application of this and not, you know, an Ignite conference keynote that talks about how fast you can translate War and Peace. When they showed like, yeah, here's how we're using it here, you're just like, okay, now I see why you're excited about these things.
Yeah, I see them on a path to not only, you know, how do you stop hackers really? How about every time you even attempt to get at us, we get you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this kind of software is smart enough that the moment it sees attempts, it sets up a honeypot. You know, typically we only go the honeypot route once we've been breached or we're being repeatedly hit enough that we can finally see a repeatable solution where it's possible to direct into honeypots to trap. But imagine if software got to a place where any attempt always worked, but was always a trap.
And being able to see, and this, you know, goes back to what we were saying a second ago. This is where I have a little more faith in these big, specifically these big public cloud companies, all the AWS, Microsoft, Google, because they've got this dedicated staff that is working on this 24/7.
And they have the surface area. They see so many attacks. They see so much data. Like the advantage of being a cloud provider in terms of optimizing your IT for all of us ultimately is that view across a huge amount of product.
Yeah. As an IT person, you know, when you walk into a NOC of one of those, you know, really big organizations and you have the ability to see like one of those, you know, all the screens up and seeing what they have to look at and everything, it really puts in perspective your organization and saying like, okay, here's what we have to deal with and look at what they have to deal with. They're at a different scale than we are. They're clearly more full-time on this.
Yeah.
Maybe it does make sense to be able to trust these guys with it because they got a lot more riding on it than just us.
And I've had that experience as a consultant too. One of the advantages of being a consultant, because I see so many projects in a given year, you can say with confidence, those numbers are normal. That condition is reasonable. Oh, wait, that's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like just because you have a broader view, this public cloud thing is the ultimate manifestation of a broad view.
It really is. I mean, in my specific world too, I mean, as far as like the SharePoint world goes, I mean, I've seen this product going back to 2003 and mm-hmm. watching it evolve from being something that Microsoft would build for 3 years, throw over the wall, we would deploy it, we'd give them feedback, to starting around 2010, 11, 12, 13, when they started hosting it themselves. And now when we see releases come out for customers who are still using SharePoint on-prem, they see something that is a hell of a lot more battle tested and easier to manage.
For sure.
Because now the company that's building it, they feel the pain and the experience of having to babysit and manage it and test it and all that stuff on your own. So, you know, we've got like another version of SharePoint on-prem coming. I think a preview's due sometime middle of 2018 and then later coming in 2019. And one of the big questions we get from people are, so what do you think's going to be in it? I'm like, go look at Office 365.
Sure.
I pretty much think that it's a subset of that.
Well, I think that all of Microsoft's products are going this way. Certainly Exchange.
Yep.
They run those features in the cloud first and they eventually take a cut they make into a product. I don't know that SQL Server's like that, but it's starting to feel that way. But absolutely with SharePoint, it's like everything gets tested in the cloud first, then pulled down.
Yep. Yep.
Hey, Andrew, give you one moment here for a very important announcement. This episode of Run As is brought to you by SQL Intersection. 8 full-day workshops and over 40 technology-focused sessions make SQL Intersection a unique source of the best information around SQL Server from real-world consultants and members of the SQL Server team. You'll learn proven problem-solving techniques and technologies you can implement immediately, as well as learn about the future of SQL Server. Get answers to performance monitoring, troubleshooting, designing for scale and performance, cloud, as well as new features in SQL Server 2016 and 2017. It's time to determine your migration strategy, and SQL Intersection is the place to figure out the best way to do it. Come to SQL Intersection at the Swan Hotel in Orlando, March 25th to 28th. Use code RUNAS to get your discount on your registration at SQLIntersection.com, and we'll see you there. And we're back. You're listening to Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell, here with Andrew Connell and talking a little bit about the SharePoint model, especially in SharePoint Online. And I think one of the big things for me looking at this from an IT perspective is The older versions of SharePoint had customizations models that were so unique to SharePoint, it was its own skill. And from an IT perspective, I found it very concerning to deploy new customized versions because you didn't know what the attack surface was like, what the stability systems were like, and so forth. But it seems when they moved to SharePoint Online, they went to standards for customization.
They've at least tried to. You're right. In the past of what it was is that it gave us different development models to extend SharePoint. But the way that we extended it was by hooking our custom code really into the SharePoint process. There was a way to isolate it in a bit, but really our stuff was being run in the context of SharePoint.
Right. And when it went wrong, it took down machines.
Exactly. It took down machines, took down farm. And when a product was built not to be multi-tenant by nature, that means I'm not just a noisy neighbor. I'm the neighbor that's burning down the entire apartment complex.
Exactly. Mom, can I use the flamethrower if I promise not to use it in the house? Like, it's just so dangerous.
Hey, if it's in a house, it's one thing. But I'm in an apartment complex. I'm taking it down for everybody. So, but what they did is when they moved to the cloud, and I think this was like 2010, 11, 12, 13. It was kind of a flux of like they were kind of in the cloud and then they had a new version of the product came out that was really more cloudy. They saw a need to be able to give people like me, so I'm a developer, they needed to give me a way to still customize and extend SharePoint the way that my customers wanted me to. But at the same time, they wanted to make sure that I couldn't bring down the farm. And then let's add the third dimension. Hey, I got to make sure that corporate IT for the customers I'm building stuff for, that they're comfortable with me building stuff without me opening up too many holes. So what we've gone through, you know, the joke is that with every version of SharePoint, we have a new development model. So Then we go to the cloud and it's like, hey, look, Evergreen. And they're like, great. So we get to have a new dev model every 2 months. Thankfully, that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
We're finally on a model now that Microsoft has done they've done a lot of work around the infrastructure piece to facilitate it, both in terms of permissions and OAuth and trusting Azure AD and giving us good REST APIs to be able to get to data outside of from off the SharePoint box, to where now we are the new dev model. It's called the SharePoint framework. And the idea is that everything that you do runs outside of SharePoint, either in the browser, so on a SharePoint page, but it's still in the browser, or you're going to run completely outside of SharePoint, like in Azure or in AWS or wherever you want it to run. And it then is going to call back into SharePoint by first authenticating with Azure AD. If you're on-prem, there's an option there. And then using the SharePoint REST APIs to get into, to talk to SharePoint to read and write. The big thing that we have today that has made things more, this is going back to what your point was about being more standards based. The SharePoint framework is all about working with client side code. And aside from them giving us a packaging model to deploy our stuff to SharePoint as one part of the SharePoint framework, and then giving us you could kind of call it an SDK. You can kind of call it an API, but really all it is just it's a series of APIs that we can use to make it easier to call the SharePoint REST API. Like it handles using the current context of the current user that's logged into SharePoint. So I don't have to go through all the authentication stuff. It just says, hey, you're already there. We've already got that. What's it called? The FedAuth cookie.
Right.
It's already on the page. We can use that to authenticate you. And we then as developers focus on just using standard client-side dev stuff. And so we could use jQuery, we can use React, we can use Angular, but it's all just standard client-side dev stuff. We're not building stuff that is so unique to saying, like today now, if I have to go hire a SharePoint dev, I'm not looking for a SharePoint dev.
Right.
First and foremost, I'm looking for a client-side dev that also understands how to call RESTful services. And then the additional, the bottom of the job description where you say other skills that would be beneficial to your job, it would maybe say, I understand what SharePoint is. I understand the concept of a site and a list and a library. But aside from that, I really don't care.
Yeah, it's not that far of a stretch, which A, means they're a heck of a lot more available. But I just like that we don't have to build up custom security tests. We don't have to invent new governance. Like, it's just a tremendous amount of work to build a really secure and stable SharePoint site. And this seems to have just simplified it a lot.
It really has. It's not only made things better for it and from a simpler point of view, but it's also given those of us who have been doing this for a while, it gives us a lot more confidence at what Microsoft is doing. And the reason I say that is because for the first time, I guess you could definitely debate me on this one, but let's just say for the most part, for the first time, how's that for a caveat? Microsoft is giving us a development model that they call first party and third party. And so what that means is that In the past, the majority of the dev models that we've had have been third party, meaning that it's something that I would use. It's something that you would use to go customize SharePoint. But when they want to build new features in SharePoint, they're not using it.
Right.
So they're not really invested or married to it as much as I have to be.
Well, we get back to the same old argument we had about Azure as a whole, right? It's like when I see Microsoft using this stuff for their own things, for their own product, I have a hell of a lot more confidence.
Exactly, yeah. When they now are using the SharePoint framework to create all the new things that they're doing inside of SharePoint. Like at Ignite in 2017, they talked about these new sites that are coming out called Hub Sites, which you can kind of think of that as like one top-level SharePoint site that is over all of your other sites in your organization. So like a corporate intranet. Or we have a new site called a communication site, or we have a whole new administrative dashboard. All of those things were built using the same framework that I'm using today in the classes that I'm building for developers.
Nice.
And when you see something like that, when I see something like that, look, hey, cards on the table. About 3 years ago, I was done with SharePoint. I was like, you know what? I've been doing this for too long. I'm done. It's just the same old over and over. But when I saw them go in this direction, I mean, I saw two angles to it. One, I saw they were going to use this as well. I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. Well, then this one might have staying power. And then the second angle that I saw to it was that they were taking the thing that people were doing the most of, which is client-side customization in SharePoint, but they were all doing like one-off kind of bespoke things on their own, using their own thing, their own tools to do it. And Microsoft brought this in and said, hey, let's make this a first-class citizen. Let's take this client-side dev that you guys are doing, and how about we put a little contract around it and so that you can do stuff and trust that we're not going to change it on you. Or if we do, we're going to change it in a supported and backwards compatible way. Let's give you a packaging model so that you don't have to give your infrastructure guy a Word doc that's 5 pages long and say, go roll this new thing out at 1 a.m. on Friday night or Saturday morning when I'm sound asleep and when we don't want to do it during live time because right. It's going to upset everyone.
Sure.
Instead, I'd rather give you a package file and just say, go run this one command and it will deploy it and install it. And it's all good to go because my stuff is now in a repeatable package deployment model.
Right. And can be rolled back. I mean, there's plenty of apps that were hard to roll back, but I'm pretty sure customized SharePoint hits the record as the hardest to roll back.
If you could roll back, then yes, I would agree with you. I had many, many a times when I was terrified. I remember the very first SharePoint deployment I did, we had an open case with Microsoft for, oh my gosh, I think it was like 7 or 8 months.
Wow.
Where we could back up our corporate intranet, but we couldn't restore it.
AKA, you don't have a backup. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they kept going back and they're like going, look, we've tested your backups. They're sound. They're fine. And I'm like going, yeah, but I haven't been able to recover from anything. And they're like, yeah, but you haven't had to recover yet. And I'm like, that's not the warm fuzzy I'm looking for.
Yeah. That's not what I'm looking for here. I'm looking for, hey, restoration is easier than backup. It just works.
Yeah. I'm terrified to roll out a big change to our intranet because if I need to roll back, I'm hoping somebody from Dallas is jumping on a plane and coming over here because I'm going to need the help. We can't do it.
Yeah. And throw somebody else into hell as well. I have to wonder in that BPOS era back in 2011, if it was the Microsoft early Azure IT guys that just kicked the SharePoint people's butts to say, look, this is not sustainable. We cannot make a cloud product out of this the way it is right now.
You know, I would not at all be surprised if that's what had happened behind the scenes.
I mean, it doesn't matter how long us as IT people yelled at them about the management challenges that were SharePoint, but when their own people hunted them down and said, this isn't happening if you don't make these changes.
Yeah. And you know what? I honestly think, and I may be being a bit naive here. I mean, I'm close with a lot of the guys in the engineering team, but mm-hmm. So this isn't, I'm not speaking in a complete vacuum here, but I still may be a little naive in thinking that I don't think that a lot of people in Redmond truly grasped what managing SharePoint was like.
No, I totally agree.
The reason I say that is because when you first, like when SharePoint 20, oh gosh, I think it was 2010 or 2013, when that came out, and then when we saw SharePoint 2016 came out.
Right.
2016, there was really nothing, there was nothing in it there for really users or developers. It was a lot of stuff that I looked at my IT pro friends and I was like, That was for you. Like this whole concept of being able to do zero downtime patching. I'm like, I don't do it, but I know that's hell for you guys. I know when you're running a cloud service, downtime isn't a thing anymore. I mean, it's not acceptable.
Right.
Well, I speak that from a very, you know, idealistic point of view, but for the most part, downtime isn't acceptable. And the same thing with like when people would want to go through and upgrade from one version to the next, we had this idea of doing content database based upgrades, but you could have a content database that was, you know, tens and tens of gigs. And now then all of a sudden it's like, hey, look, new feature in 2016. It's a minimal database. It's a tiny database. I'm like, you guys are experiencing the same pain that we've been experiencing for the last decade.
Exactly. And it is good news to me that they're still going to make an on-premises version, because I think for someone who's now operating SharePoint, being on the latest bits just means it's going to be a lot easier to manage.
Yeah, I think the main reason, I'm not going to speak for Microsoft here. I'm going to be just pure opinion here on this one. There are a certain number of customers who cannot go from on-prem SharePoint to the cloud. I mean, there are people who would just, the way that their business is run, and then based on geopolitical rules. Like I had one customer who was a oil and gas company, and they had SharePoint deployments in Libya. We could not move them to the cloud because Libya had a rule that said any data that you create or accumulate from work, from pulling resources out of Libyan soil, has to stay on Libyan soil. It can't go to the cloud. I'm like, okay, can't get around that.
No, I've dealt with the fact, you know, Luxembourg requires any email origin in Luxembourg to be stored in Luxembourg.
There you go. Okay, yeah. So it's stuff like that. There's companies that are going to have that requirement. But I still think that if you put a gun to somebody's head at Microsoft and said, hey, look, if I had to put the gun in there, I guess I'm American, right? So that was totally off the top of my head. I didn't mean to say that.
Nice.
So I would suspect that Microsoft would say, look, life would be so much easier for us in the SharePoint and Office space if SharePoint was only in the cloud and Office 365.
Right.
We can rev it faster. We can maintain it better. We get better vision. I mean, the whole reason we have the SharePoint framework is because they looked at all the deployments of SharePoint on Office 365, and they said, hey, look, the most common thing that people are using to customize is with something called the script editor web part and the content editor web part. That's how you do client-side dev.
Right.
We need to give them a way to do client-side dev. But the main reason I think that we still have SharePoint on-prem is because it is still a big business. It's still, what, a $1 or $2 billion business?
Sure.
And when Microsoft rolls around, or salespeople in the field roll around, they say, hey, it's time to re-sign your enterprise agreement for hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions or, you know, whatever. And the customer says, well, there's no SharePoint on-prem anymore, so we're not going to re-sign it.
Yeah.
It's amazing what customers and dollars can actually get them to do. So I think honestly, the reason why we still have an on-prem version is primarily for companies to keep that revenue stream going. But I would bet you that Microsoft would really like to take this to Office 365 exclusively. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
But they've always wanted that. They've always wanted the recurring revenue model. They've always wanted that central managed. But, you know, the art of being a leader is figuring out where the crowd is going and running in front of them. So, you know, just acknowledging the fact that there is a non-trivial number of customers that are on-prem and happy. So keep making product.
Yep.
And clearly we saw that at Ignite, where they said, yep, I love that they announced in 2017 a 2019 version. Like, that is, you know, a long way out, but okay. You know, and I appreciate it. It's just going to be SharePoint Online, cut and tested across more hardware so that we can fit it onto our on-premise systems.
The nice thing too is, I mean, it again, from the developer point of view, from my side, with this new development model that we have, there are ways for us to build things that are going to go on-prem, but you can build them in the spirit that they're going to go in Office 365.
Sure.
So, you know, IT groups within organizations that are on-prem, it's not like we're building stuff and you're being stuck on-prem.
Right.
We build stuff in a way that we need to be able to make it cloud friendly. And there's things, you know, helping them understand the challenges that you could run into or things that they need to watch out for people like me that are building these things. So
I've absolutely had the conversation with Jared Shockley, actually, who did a show a couple of years ago talking about one of his jobs was migrating all of Microsoft's SharePoint sites up to SharePoint Online. Mm. And he said it was like 90% lift and shift. Mm. But the other 10, hoo boy.
those are the ones that we looked at and said, is there any way we can just retire this?
Yeah. Can you retire it? Can you upgrade it to a later version? Are we going to have to put this crazy thing in a bunch of VMs? But again, it made me smile to talk to a Microsoft IT guy about exactly the same problems that everybody else is having when they look at this. That it's true that most of the stuff will move to the cloud if you want to. And certainly in the new models, they're making it very clear they'll simply go across. But there are some customizations, especially in the earlier versions, that are going to bite you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's things that they gave us the ability to do for a very long time that we should not be doing today. Looking back, we shouldn't have done it either. But I mean, we can't change the history. No. So it's just, how do we move forward with this? And it's, how do I take what we did here? Does it still apply today? Yes, it does. Okay. Well, then let's use one of the, you know, the fun terms today. Let's reimagine how we would do it in this new model, and let's build it the right way this time. And not to say we did it the wrong way last time, but, you know, knowing what we know now,
yeah,
we should be doing things differently.
And I appreciate that you're sensitive to that, Andrew, that I'm a big believer in reminding everyone we made the best decision we could at the time with the knowledge we had. We always end up with more knowledge later that might have changed that decision. But don't begrudge the decisions we made. They were made with good intent. Now we just have to go forward from whatever it may be.
I was standing at a conference in Chicago just 2 weeks ago, and someone challenged me during a workshop that I was giving and said, you know, I've been following your blog for many years, and you used to promote building things like X, Y, and Z, and now you're telling me that's a dumb idea. Why in the world did I listen to your advice at the time? And I'm like, if I was in your shoes, I'd be asking the same question. But here's what we knew at the time, and here's the direction that things were going.
Right.
And look where we are today. And I would tell you right now that that stuff that I told you back then made perfect sense back in 2009, 2010. At least to me, it did then, and it still does now. But knowing what I know today, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it because it doesn't make sense today. And where we are, I mean, my goodness, the world has changed since last summer, right?
Sure.
The way that we're all doing things. I mean, I'm still amazed. When you sit down and talk to someone, like, during a holiday season, and you sit with your family and they're not in the tech space that we're all in, and they start asking, you know, what's this cloud thing and all that stuff. And it's hard to express to them, going, you realize that just like 3, 4, 5 years ago, we're doing things today that were simply not possible 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's stuff that 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was all like science fiction going, yeah, yeah, that's never going to happen. And you see it today, you're like, holy crap, this is just absolutely seeing the way you can crunch and you can slice and dice data and crunch it and have these different, you know, forecast models come out. And a company, you know, I run a video training business, and I don't have to have this huge infrastructure to go run. Yeah. I just subscribe to a couple cloud-based services that scale on their own, and I don't have a really high bill doing it or a huge sunk cost. I mean, that's incredible to me.
I do feel like we're riding up that hockey stick these days, that this is happening faster and faster. And while you certainly can feel like you're drowning, it's also amazing.
I love people in our position when you're in a, and I mean, I'm speaking as a whole, not just you and me, but everybody in our organizations. When we go to a conference and I have somebody in the room that complains about something else to learn, and I'm like, oh man, you should have been a lumberjack, because this is not the business to be in if you don't like to learn. This is one of the coolest things about this business, is that I love the fact that I get paid to learn and to teach it, but I am blown away by just, I mean, every time you turn around, that there's something else. There's some other epic thing that happens every 2-3 weeks.
Always a chance to do more.
Yep.
Hey, Andrew, super fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.